Welcome to the Negative Positives Podcast, episode 394. I'm your host, Mike Gutterman, coming to you from a very fall-like Gutterman cave here in Louisville, Kentucky. And I'm battling a bit of a sinus infection, so I'll be sniffling and trying not to cough through this episode, but I'll soldier through it because that's what we do for the fine folks here. And this is a Monday episode. We have co-captains, we have a cabin boy, and we have a special guest tonight. So let's get to the co-captains first. All the way out in Los Angeles, California, La La Land, the City of Angels, Mr. Andre Dominguez. How are you doing tonight, Andre?
I'm doing very well, Mike. Thank you very much.
Oh, nice. Well, you don't have to thank me, you know. But you're welcome.
All right. I'm feeling grateful. I'm in a grateful mood.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Yeah.
And all the way out in Virginia, Jessica Jones. How are you doing tonight, Jess?
Pretty good.
Nice. Well, we got, last week or 2 weeks ago when we had this, we brought out the cabin boy, and he did such a good job at swabbing our decks that we thought we would let him out again because, I mean, you should have seen how much our woody decks were glistening after he was on our, our show. So we're going to let him back out of the cabin boy quarters. Mr. Mike Kukavica, the drunk dark room. How you doing tonight, Mike?
Hey, I'm really glad to be here. Feeling good. Thank you, Mike. And you know what I had wanted to say, and I forgot last time, given the context of the podcast, that I was swabbing the poop deck, mister. I know that's 2 weeks late, but still. Yeah.
Well, it's a joke that just keeps on giving, I think.
It does.
I got actually an email. Someone thankful for me bringing up that subject, I guess. And so I'll read that in the next listener interaction episode. But I actually got some positive feedback about that that colonoscopy segment, which was surprising. my wife called it asinine. What?
It's such a good word, but when you have a dual meaning, it's so much better.
I gotta give him credit for that one. I gotta give him credit. It's a good one. All right, and then our guest from. I'm gonna say it wrong. Coventry, I guess it's UK. I probably pronounced that wrong. I probably didn't say it like an Englishman. But we have Mr. Chris O'Connell, who is actually in the States. This is one of the rare occasions that we kind of get to have somebody on the episode that's from across the pond because he's visiting the United States. He's in Florida, which hopefully bracing for what may be a hurricane hitting that area. So hopefully you get out of that okay, Chris. But how you doing tonight, sir?
I'm very good, thanks, Mike. And not a bad pronunciation, but it's Coventry. So
Coventry.
Coventry, you know, so rather than Coventry, which it's not quite. Yeah, you got to hit the vowel a bit harder.
Oh yeah. I got to get a little more of that English in me. You know, the Coventry.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Mike's not necessarily the one you go to that you look for you know, proper pronunciation of words.
Oh, come on now. Hello, governor. That's pretty good, right?
Apples and pears, mate. It's actually a great joy, actually, for the Brits to hear Americans doing English accents because it's just endless giggles, really. It's great.
Well, I know the famous American doing an English accent. Apparently, horribly was I think it was like Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah,
that's like kind of famous for like being horrible or whatever, I guess. So, but I think I'm at least up to that standard. I hope so. You know,
but I mean that's just the London accent. I mean, it's, you know, it's the same, I guess. You know, with American dialects and regions, you know, they're all different, aren't they? So it'd be great to hear some of you maybe trying some Geordie sometime or something like that.
I don't even know what that is, so trust me, I'm sure I'd be bad at it.
Geordie is kind of, they speak a bit like that, don't you know?
Oh, okay.
They're on the northeast coast of England. It's very, very kind of sing-song. Yeah.
What area is the Oasis guys from? Because I can never understand those guys.
Oh, they're Manchester.
Okay, yeah, they're impossible to understand, at least for me. But
that's because they used to be sort of taken something anyway, I suspect.
Right. Well, you must be getting quite a culture shock of accents down in the great state of Florida.
Did you meet the Florida man yet?
The Florida man.
Every news story with something crazy always starts with Florida man. Something insane right behind it.
Right?
No, I've been a few times to Florida, and I think I haven't so far yet, because I think there's not many people out and about at the moment because of the impending storm. But I've met a few Florida men, I think.
just you wait. Once the hurricane makes landfall, there'll be some interesting characters out doing questionable activities in the middle of the storm.
Yeah, maybe I just need to go and hang around Walmart a bit more, like sort of 4 a.m. or something.
Yeah, that'll do it.
All right. Well, Chris, this is your first time on Negative Positive. So I guess we need to learn a little bit about you. How about you tell the fine folks how you got into this photography madness and a little bit how you got into photography and how it got you to where to the fame that you're getting today here on this episode. So
appearing on podcast. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's quite hard, isn't it, I suppose, to, because I've always kind of worked like in arts and events. I'm a playwright by trade. So I've worked with a lot of theatre companies and in theatre for many years over here in the UK, and toured work into America and into Europe as a writer and as a producer. So I've always kind of been taking that perspective on my life in terms of looking to try and sort of articulate or express, you know, my kind of personal take on things. And so and I guess photography is very much an extension of that. You know, it's about a way of seeing the world in the same way that making a play is, or writing a piece of music. It's about, this is my offering of how I sort of see things at the moment. Mm-hmm. So those two things were always kind of, I suppose, closely combined. Even though I was pursuing a career as a, say, in theatre, equally, I'd sort of grown up. I remember growing up, sort of staring at pictures in a encyclopedia that we had in the house when I was probably 10 or 11, and like it was a picture of some soldiers who were killed at Gettysburg, and it was one of the very early pictures. You know, it must have been taken, you know, that sort of time. You know, when film was just emerging. You know, and I remember sort of staring at these sort of dead soldiers, but sort of seeing life kind of captured there, if you like. You know, so there was that kind of fascination about how does that, what does it all kind of mean? You know, to actually capture a moment in time like that. So there was. Not that I think I articulated it at that time in my head, but I think looking back, that they were the things I was fascinated with, you know, pictures.
It's interesting to me that you actually used encyclopedias for something that educational, something that would influence you possibly in photography, because we had a set of encyclopedias, and I mostly looked at it for the female reproduction system.
I'd sort of done that, though. Then I sort of, you know, obviously...
Well, we didn't have the internet, folks. I mean, come on.
Yeah, no, yeah.
It's the 1970s. You know?
Well, between that and National Pornographic, right? I mean, Geographic, right?
Yeah, man, you had to, you know, that or like I remember hearing this guy, this radio DJ, talking about, I think it was Adam Carolla on Loveline, would talk about how kids got it made these days. The only female he had to look at was like this girl on the box of a pool float that his parents had bought or something. So. And I had an encyclopedia, so there you go. But sorry to sidetrack that.
No, it's it all kind of adds to the to the debate.
All right, Chris, continue, man.
But I never really kind of picked up cameras, if you like, even though I obviously took digital photos easily, you know, because the Instamatics were the sort of the thing of the time, you know. But always just kind of having this fascination for it, and buying one of the first serious kind of photography books I bought was a collection of works by Sebastião Salgado, the Brazilian photographer, which just kind of blew my mind in terms of the black and white photography, his work. And
he's incredible. He inspires me as well. Just that documentary that came out about him, I think it was like 2000. 15 or something. It was in theaters. Oh my God, incredible. Salt of the Earth, was that what it was called?
No, this was the one that he did of, it was mainly around factories and industry. So he took, it's just such a really, really heavy, thick book, which I actually use when I've been printing in a dark room. I use it to sort of like to kind of flatten out. If I've been printing on fiber, I'll sort of use the book to flatten them out when they're dry, you know, because it's so heavy and thick.
That's awesome.
It's almost like you have him in the dark room with you. You know, he's like,
absolutely. Yeah. Trying to absorb a bit of his genius, you know.
Right.
but again, I think I was just like, just looking at that stuff. Again, I was sort of seeing, I suppose, that there was this other way of kind of looking at the world, which was just really interesting to me, but I hadn't quite got there, if you know what I mean. And so I was mainly just a casual camera user for many years. And also because of the whole notion of f-stops and, it was all far too mathematic for me. So I just kind of, you know, geared away from anything to do with sort of numbers, I think. But then, and then literally just about 2015, 16, someone literally just kind of stuck up on Facebook that they were selling a digital camera. And I kind of knew the guy pretty well and just kind of, I don't know why, I just said, yeah, I'll have it. So it was just like a Canon GRX, one of those, pretty good sort of digital. And I just bought that. And then, but then I just very quickly kind of, I suppose being of that, going back my, you know, to that sort of thing of the encyclopedias and all that sort of stuff, you know, is that I'm very much an analog kind of guy, you know, so I grew up with vinyl and obviously with analog photography and all that sort of stuff. So I was quickly very interested in going past the digital sort of thing. So this kind of got me into sort of, again, looking at, I've been said several times, it's got me into looking at the world somehow differently. And it was somehow tying into my writing as well. It was a really interesting way of like, you can live somewhere for a long time and just kind of stop seeing a place, you know? And so that fascination was growing, but being the kind of ultra sort of hobbyist that I am as well, that, you know, I buy bass guitars and cycles and cameras and vinyl and, you know, all of those things just kind of religiously.
You are also a musician, which is one thing I'm very happy to have you on for, because it's nice to find somebody else that's also perpetually broke, always buying music gear and cameras. So,
never making my money back on anything, but
you know, right.
Never learning a lesson. So then I started to buy, started to buy film cameras and, my friend who, of course, we all sad to lose last year, John Whitmore, who's a friend of mine in Coventry, who passed away pretty much this time last year. I think next month it's the anniversary. He
doesn't seem like it's been that long. Jeez, that's crazy.
Yeah. Nearly a year, yeah. And we knew each other sort of on the art scene, if you like, and he often collaborated with my company taking pictures or whatever. So I spent, I said to him, you know, tell him about this growing passion, fascination. And so he got me over to his dark room, which was called the Dark Shed, at the bottom of the garden, and spent quite a lot of time with him in there, sort of just learning about, you know, he kind of took me through the whole things, really, of how you get to digital printing, analog printing, you know. So that really just set me off. And then, so John and I would sort of like hang out, take shots or whatever. And obviously I would just then, like I think a lot of us, you know, just kind of go out and just trawl the streets and, you know, naturally turn myself straight away initially to street photography, debate what street photography is. You know, I know that debate's out there, but, you know, the idea of some candid photography, some just landscape, urban landscape, whatever, and some quite clearly, so maybe like portrait photography on the streets as well and all that sort of stuff. And just trying to just really learn how to sort of, how to take good photos, interesting photos. And that's kind of been the journey, really. And I've kind of been through the whole gamut of different formats. And I mean, John always said a good thing that, you know, he owned one good camera across every format. And I kind of think, being a hobbyist that I am, I've probably got three good cameras across every format.
I hear you there. So when you got what was the first film camera you got when you?
I think it was an Olympus OM2N, I think. Mm-hmm. I think that's the, they had so many different derivatives of it, but I think it was the OM2N or N2, one or the other. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure which way around. So yes, that was the first one I started shooting on, yeah.
And then
first 35 millimeter was an Olympus OM1N.
Right, okay.
Great cameras.
Oh, fantastic! Yeah, Yeah, I mean, it kind of wasn't enough. I wanted to other stuff, you know.
Right.
But I also kind of became quite interested in the whole kind of rangefinder approach as well. So I ended up with a Leica. just getting so you could sort of get your. I haven't mentioned Hasselblad yet, so.
Hasselblad. So you, when you got into this film thing, obviously, it sounds like you were hanging out with John a little bit. But I mean, did you, when you first started thinking about going to film, did you kind of know that this film thing was kind of growing and back, having a second life, a resurrection, a rebirth? Did you know that was kind of happening, or did you find out after you kind of like, I think I might shoot film again? I mean, did you realize that there was kind of this we like to call it a revival or renaissance kind of going on?
I would say, genuinely sort of kind of ignorant to it, if you like, in the fact that it wasn't really. I knew that digital had sort of surpassed most things analog, by the time I was starting to sort of look towards film. But at the same time, I suppose growing up with it, it never really, I hadn't sort of thought one way or the other that it had died away and then it was making a resurgence. But obviously the more that I kind of began to experiment with it, because then I also set up, when my youngest son left home for university, I said to him, well, that's it, I'm having your little bedroom, which was at the top of the house. So I made up my own dark room, set a dark room up in there. So when I started to print in there, which I still do, obviously, that's when you really get a sense of, the way that the industry has had this resurgence, but equally how much it hurts your pocket as well.
right.
Definitely.
Did you, so it sounds like you didn't take long to kind of go from shooting to straight to doing darkroom work. That didn't sound like it was a very long process. Like, it sounded like you were into it pretty quick, right?
Yeah, well, I was really keen just to kind of I wasn't mad on the idea of of developing the roll of film, and then I did initially do that. I developed the film at home, whatever, and then scan everything, and that was kind of how I began to sort of like translate from the camera to actually being able to see the image. But that, again, I just felt, I suppose, searching for that authenticity of the experience. I just kind of felt, and having spent time with John in his darkroom, I wanted that extra, what I suppose I felt for me was something that felt a bit closer to that experience. But equally, everyone has their own sort of process, and other people are, absolutely right and happy that they work purely to, from film to scan, and then that's where their process ends. But I was kind of like wanting a bit more. So, so I was, again, climbing that sort of greasy pole quite quickly.
Did you, do you feel like you enjoy the darkroom just as much as you enjoy the shooting process, or do you have a part of the process you like better, or is it just the whole enchilada, they would say.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because there is that classic thing, I mean, a friend of my son, the guy who's the one whose bedroom I stole, his friend was into photography, and I said to him, look, do you want a film camera? Because he was shooting on a really, I think it was like one of those really nice Fuji digitals that are out there. I said, do you want to borrow a film camera for a bit, and I'll give you a roll of film? And he said, oh, go on then. And I said, you know all about how it all the printing, don't you? He said, well, I kind of do. I said, well, come on, come upstairs. So we went into the dark room, and the point I'm getting to is that translation from, I kind of put like a negative into the neg holder and sort of like turned on the red, did all the thing, red lights on, all that sort of stuff. And I was explaining to him that here is where you kind of like, it happens with the light hits the neg, and then it burns, it's onto paper, and then you turn around to the wet side. And he was like, what? And then instead, like, on the other side of the room is your wet side, and then you kind of have all the developing. And he was just like, he's about 23, 24. He'd never seen anything like this, and he was kind of blown away by it. And that was kind of a bit, I think, even for me as a grown man, when I started doing it, that thing is just magical, and you can't get past that. I think everyone says that, don't they, when they've worked been in dark rooms, is to see that image suddenly appearing on the paper is just it's brilliant. So I kind of enjoy both as much, really. I think I'm I don't think I'm any more proficient at one or the other. You know, just
right.
Always a constant sort of learning thing, really, with it. And then, of course, I've gone on to destroy loads of stuff I've done in the dark room. My process has led me into lots of other things where I've actually set about destroying stuff that I've labored over printing and then just attacked it with paint and sandpaper. And let's maybe we'll come on to that.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that we will. I've got a quick question for you, Chris. With the proximity of the darkroom printing side of things to the beginning of your analog photography journey, do you think that that had an effect on what you were choosing to shoot, how you were choosing to expose? I mean, everybody's different, but Mike and I, Kukovica and I are, I think, perhaps oftentimes to a fault, technical photographers, and we have to try to make sure that we don't kind of lose our creativity in the pursuit of a negative that's going to be easiest to print. What effect did that have on you? Because I hear all the time that people, once they start printing, they're like, oh man, I've been shooting in such a way that was making my life harder as a printer for so long, and I wish I'd started printing earlier because I would have had a body of work that would just be so much easier and less expensive to make into a print.
Yeah, I think it certainly teaches you, and you begin to sort of understand that, you know, that the exposure exposure is just so important, you know, and you just got to really just, I suppose, you know, think through as much as possible, really what you're going to do with the photograph. And so that, you know, and exposing for the shadows, and you really begin to understand what that kind of means when you actually go back and try and print stuff. And obviously vice versa with the highlights as well. So, you know, when suddenly something's just kind of blown out, you know, because you've just completely screwed up the exposure, you kind of quickly sort of like learn, you know, for that. But equally, I suppose with the stuff that I moved into creating, you know, some of the more experimental work, I was actually gleefully sort of less concerned in a way about the quality of the technical work I was doing through the camera, because I had other plans for the image, which were beyond the sort of the black and white sort of silver gelatin, you know. That's kind of been interesting as well, that I suppose what I'm saying is I was quite intimidated by the darkroom to begin with because of the things you've just said, and sort of feeling that, oh, you know, what's it going to look like? You know, oh God, I just can't do this. You know, that kind of, that feeling. But equally going down the line and actually just becoming in my head more free about what I wanted to do with a camera and with an image anyway, and actually realizing that the darkroom was just a small part of that process actually. Towards something else.
I definitely want to dive deeper into some of the stuff that you've done, which is I'm sure the fine folks, when they listen to this episode, they should check out your website and your Instagram account, because there's just some of the photos. I mean, you have altered to the point where they look more like paintings. It's really quite amazing what you've done. But and I want to like get more into those processes a little bit later in the conversation. But just in general. Sure. How did you, I mean, what made you attracted to basically messing up your negatives and your prints or whatever to get these looks? What made you decide that, you know what, I want to get weird. I want to get weird with this, you know?
Yeah.
How did you get to that point?
Again, I don't think I could absolutely sort of nail, you know, a cast iron sort of alibi as to why they ended up like that. But I've often thought about it, and I suppose it was being so attached, I suppose, to exploring story through theatre and working so much through metaphor and, you know, as you try and tell stories in that way, or like through film, you know, that I kind of felt that what I was producing in the darkroom was, you know, so it was a black and white, I think, reasonably good reproduction of the negative. But I kind of wanted more, and it didn't quite, somehow it just wasn't quite capturing what I wanted, you know. And I don't know what it was. I think it just kind of came to me. And I mean, I'd sort of I'd been aware of some work by other photographers who'd interacted or worked in some kind of mixed media sort of way. People like Dwayne Michaels, who I think one of the comments was on the web page, on the Facebook page, you know, who began to sort of like write across his prints and stuff like that and begin to sort of interact with them. And I think that was what I was kind of lacking, is that it, going back to Andre's point as well, it was all quite technical at that point, but I wasn't really sort of, just didn't really, I couldn't really feel that much. Didn't, you know, I think about the picture, I could remember the picture where I took it and how I felt when I took it. But then printing it, it just kind of felt a very technical exercise. And so I wanted to somehow go deeper to what it felt like to stand on the street and take that particular photograph. So that's when I started to kind of just mess around with things, really.
So there's the thing that, you know, I think it was Anzo Adams that said the dark room was like the performance of a musical piece. And so you basically turned your dark room into a grungy punk rock rehearsal space and with some distorted guitar, basically, right?
mainly a lot of reggae sort of was my mess up kind of music. So I had like my record player tucked in the corner. So yeah, it was usually just a bit of Burning Spear or whatever, and just a bit of reggae, and just get to it, you know. But funny enough, I've never sort of imbibed in there, so it's never been influenced by drugs or alcohol or anything. It's really just been wanting
to. You don't drink a beer when you're working in the dark room?
No, I don't. No, it's funny that. No, I don't, because and I've heard people on this podcast and other podcasts sort of, you know, I know it's to take Mike's patent, you know, it's the man cave, isn't it? Or yeah, you know, obviously, and also the woman cave as well, obviously. But I do a lot of. But I know it kind of somehow goes hand in hand, and I do a lot of cycling as well. And you know, a lot of cyclists like to kind of stop off for a pint of something, you know. And I never mix the two. I don't know why. I just like to keep them separate, really. So
that's it. You know what? You're a man that knows when he wants his alcohol and wants to enjoy it for its own special time, yeah. Right? So
that's right.
No,
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was just going to make a drunk darkroom comment. But I mean, Mike has to drink in his darkroom because that's his name of his Instagram account.
Yeah, that's true.
I was just about to ask him, so do you drink in the darkroom, Mike? And then I thought, no, that's a dumb question, isn't it? Drunk darkroom.
Just water, just water.
No, there's some beers going on, but I try not to drink too much because the dodging and burning gets progressively worse as that goes on.
Yeah, I can understand that.
What'd you have, Jess?
So you said it started very technical and it wasn't enough, and you started to add more and more into it. And as someone who loves alternative photography, one of the reasons I really love it is because it feels so freeing, and I can allow a lot of mistakes to come in, and I can just kind of run with how other mediums change, whether it be because of the temperature outside or just kind of the feeling in the moment. Is that something that's part of your work, or is there like a very technical side in the way that you use your mixed mediums?
Jess, come with the tough questions.
Sorry, I'm just very curious.
Can you just say a bit more, Jess, about what you...
Yeah, just when you... So I guess a good question would be, or a more specific way of asking it would be, when you're working on this mixed media stuff, do you envision it before you've started, or do you kind of let it take you on that journey in itself and it kind of comes out the way it comes out? Or do you kind of see the piece before it's finished?
No, I don't necessarily, no. But sometimes an image that I might choose to kind of... I mean, I remember I took some photos in some fantastic forests up in sort of northeast coast of Scotland, and I was printing some of that stuff, and it was like I was printing it quite big. I think 12 by 12:16, isn't it, or something like that? I think it's so. It's like, you know, yeah, no, or 11 by 16, something like that. It was one of the biggest sort of like papers, and I was printing it, but I knew that I wanted to sort of work on it, you know, to do something to it, if you like, and. It was the atmosphere of the of that I'd captured in the woods actually sort of like took me down the route that I went, you know. So that was a very kind of, so it became quite sort of a, quite a sort of very sort of textured and quite dark piece, you know, on top of the, I mean, it wasn't shot, it wasn't sort of printed particularly sort of dark, if you like, but just the feeling of, I remembered of being in that forest and it was, I didn't see anyone all day sort of thing, you know, and you're constantly thinking you're going to be attacked by an axe murderer. It was that kind of, that kind of like isolation and yet thrilling as well. So all of that kind of informed, I suppose, what I decided to do to that particular image. But other stuff has just been my, we're kind of moving into process at the moment, Mike, so I don't know if you want to go there yet, but, but sorry, did you say?
That's fine. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So like, my wife, she's, she works, this is why she's been out in the States. She was in Mississippi last week working with the G's Bend quilters from, Alabama, and she's a textile artist. So she does a lot of, she just works with materials in lots of different ways and with a lot of kind of, plant dyes and, you know, homegrown plants and dye, using those dyes, you know, oil up a whole bag.
That
of
That is very cool.
Yeah, yeah. So I began to, so this is a couple of summers ago, she was doing a lot of that. So I was like collecting my own onion skins in a little bag and just keeping them in the freezer, in the fridge, sorry. And then I kind of boiled them up and sort of chucked them into a, you know, into the tray where the, I had like a spare developer tray. So I just kind of poured all of that mix into the tray and then just kind of stuck this 12-16 sort of fiber print into there, and this incredible sort of color just began to kind of like wash over the print, you know, and it was just amazing to watch, you know, and it somehow was like the perfect expression of how I was kind of feeling at that point as well, you know, in terms of, you know, having some kind of mental health issues that are ongoing, you know, for some years or whatever, and it was that kind of suddenly that this color that just kind of came out was so natural and yet felt like it was completely changing who I was in that image, even though it was definitely me because it was a self-portrait that I took, but suddenly it wasn't me, it was someone else. And that's where a lot of that, there's a whole load of stuff on Instagram of a lot of that work came from, when I began to then attack it in different ways with different sort of mediums, you know, like sandpaper or Indian ink or like say plant dyes and oil paint and gouache and you know, all those different kind of like paint sort of mediums that you can use as well, because it was somehow, it could somehow transform the image from no longer being me but to being somehow some kind of external expression of what of the kind of naturalistic picture that I'd taken. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
There's a funny,
it makes total sense also that you're using, you know, fiber paper, since it's a lot more receptive to any kind of like tinting or coloring and stuff like that. Do you have any experience with the Ilford Art 300 paper?
Is that the kind of, these are really nice kind of like it's like the antique-y sort of feel. Is that the one?
It's like textured. It's almost like watercolor paper, right?
Yeah, I
love that stuff. Yeah. So much.
Yeah, I've not used a lot of it, but I have done bits and bobs. I think actually, contradicting myself totally, I was probably more scared of it because that paper's so expensive that I didn't really want to.
Oh, man. Yeah, it is, but it's like it's one of those things I don't think I could live without, right? I mean, it's not like the only paper you can have, but it's so good for the right thing.
Yeah.
And I've seen people hand color those or selectively color that, and it's so good. I mean, I don't have that skill. Like partly after I get done with making a print, I'm like, how can I screw this up? I don't want to touch it. Like even thinking about selenium toning, it is scary. Like the bleaching and like redeveloping it. I'm like, no, it's good right now.
Yeah.
So I want to get to where you are, Chris. I'm just not there yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and also I suppose the other thing I love actually work, which I didn't think would, but it's like, is working with gloss as well, glossy paper. Because actually, when you take sandpaper to that, this is sacrilege for, you know. Sort of
it's not. It's just like, it's such an alien concept, though. It's like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, you take sandpaper to it, and then so you're taking off some of the veneer, and then you kind of like begin to put, say, Indian ink over the top of that. It just embeds itself in with, you know, the bits that have been taken off. Obviously, you know, so you've kind of got this kind of weird sort of like landscape of texture on the actual paper. And then again, you can build on top of that. You know, you can actually then begin to sort of, you know, paint around some of the, maybe the landscapes in the background or this, you know, urban landscape. You can just kind of, and sometimes it turns out really badly, and or sometimes you just keep going and just do, oh no, that's great, I'm going to do another one, you know. And actually, going back to Mike's point about drinking, I do remember drinking a lot, not a lot in one go, but always having a drink on the go when I was doing that kind of work, because they were all printed and they dried off. And so the next day I'd come back to them and just, I'd be in the kitchen and just kind of get all my kind of other stuff out, all my sandpaper and paints and stuff. Some of the various lockdowns we had in the UK and stuff. And I'd get the sports on the radio, and just, I'd be in there for hours, just like, you know, a few cans of beer and sandpaper and paint, and just kind of creating these other worlds. It was an enjoyable time.
Are you saying that you had to be partly drunk to be able to screw up your prints? I'm joking. I mean, you're British, so sarcasm isn't lost on you, my friend.
So you're on E, I think French say, don't they?
Yeah, there you go. But that's so crazy, though. That's so crazy. Cool.
I was looking at your Instagram. I was looking at your Instagram before the episode here to jot down some, you know, some show notes. You know, I do a lot of pre-production for these shows. And why are you all laughing, man?
No idea. Sorry, that was spontaneous.
And one thing there was, I saw one of the photos that you had put in the description, that there was something with the onion skins involved. And and it was really an interesting photo. And I thought, well, that is the first time I've seen an onion used for good in this world, because onions are the devil's fruit, and they should not be allowed in any form other than maybe in photographic processes, because they should be.
Your palate is so strange to me.
Onions are horrible, man. It's a
devil's fruit. Oh, my God.
Yeah, put them with other things, Mike, and then they're not so bad. You know, they kind
onions
of
are incredible. Incredible things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my God. In every form.
Nope. No, except the only good onion is Funyuns. The chips Funyuns. That's the only.
I love Funyuns.
Oh, geez. Funyuns are, yeah. No, those are
they're good. Those are good, but the only is kind of strong, Mike. That's kind of strong.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah, well, I like Funyuns, but onions can go to hell. But so except for in Chris's photography, we'll let him use it. All right,
Funyuns and Chris's photography, otherwise straight to hell with you.
Straight, yeah. No need for those things. And anybody else have any general questions with Chris before we move, take a break, and get to the Facebook questions? Any last things you want to follow up before we dive a little deeper?
No, I'm excited to hear more.
Yeah, I mean, the only other comment that I have here is that you know, I'm sad that Roxana was not able to join us, because this, you know, having examined some of the work and some of the discussions we've been having in terms of experimentation in the dark room, and you know, letting go of sometimes of the technical aspect in service of exploration and playfulness with photography, this is right up her alley.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I think that's something that I've kind of learned through that creative sort of career that I've talked about as well. You know, and like, if you think about people like the French film director, you know, Godard, who died last week, you know, that he, you know, it's that kind of approach, I think, to creativity, which is so important, is that there, you know, the only rules is that there are no rules, you know, and that's, so, you know, and you can dissect that as a comment, and you can defend it and attack it in lots of different ways. Obviously, you know, and I suppose the adage is you kind of have to learn the rules before you can break them, arguably. But, you know, I think that's, for me, has always been the key thing. Just don't, you know, art should always be radical, I think, you know, and you have to just kind of be, I mean, Julia was saying, my wife, you know, when she was on the Mississippi thing with the G's Bend quilters, and they were saying, you know, what you're doing in this workshop, it's your quilt. It's no one else's quilt. It's your quilt. And they kept saying this, you know, and it really kind of makes, you know, that's what they were saying. It's yours and nobody else's. That art belongs to you first and foremost. Mm. And that's kind of, yeah.
I like that a lot. Yeah. Yeah. Because I think a lot of times when you're creating something, whether it be your photography or like music or whatever, a lot of times you do in the back of your mind, if you're not careful, you can let the wonder, well, what will people think of this? Will they like this, or will they respond to it? And really, it's really the only important thing is that you respond to it, I guess, right?
Yeah,
and that's genuine, which should by default be something that people pick up on, just a genuineness in your creative outlets. So yeah, very cool. All right, well let's go ahead and take a little break. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, sorry. I was just gonna say like, I tend to think like silver gelatin prints, no two are the same if you do any dodging and burning, right? But that's one thing. But like what you're doing, Chris, that's like on a whole other level right there. I mean, there's no way that the intervention or the work that you do on those could be copied, even if you tried your darndest, right? It's just not.
Yeah.
It's like it takes one of a kind to another level, which is cool.
Because everyone is an original, isn't it, in that respect? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right. Well, we're going to take a little break here and come back. We got a couple of Facebook questions to Chris, and we're going to get into those. And I'm sure all of us here want to ask, get in a little bit more of some of this weirdness that Chris has going on, some of these processes. So, because there's some very interesting work on his social media. So, but we'll take us a break and we'll be right back, folks. Folks, we are back from the break, and I just found out during the break that Mr. Chris O'Connell has really, first of all, you know, he's really experiencing America if he's in Florida, first of all. And then secondly, has went to the Walmarts, as some people like to call them around here, and picked up some, I think one of America's premium offers in the libations category, and that's a fine Pilsner beer, Miller Lite. And I'm happy to see that he is enjoying real American culture. And Chris, what do you think about the fine Pilsner beer, Miller Lite?
Yeah, it's it has a certain je ne sais quoi.
I've heard Miller Lite described a lot of ways.
It's kind of it was cold when I started it. It's possible. It reminds me a bit of the beer we used to drink in the university bars in the 80s in Coventry, where there was taught that there was a lot of other sort of like amberish kind of liquids mixed in with the beer. I don't know. You can sort of follow that train of thought. I'm sure. A bit like it, is what I'm saying.
Well, now you know what freedom tastes like, though. So
yeah.
That's the important thing. So, but all right.
But y'all don't really have cold beer in England, though, do you?
Yeah. Yeah, got lots of cold beer.
well, what's the definition of cold, right? Because I've been to England twice, and in like 2004, I went to Woking. And they had the extra cold Guinness. And I was like, this is still piss warm.
Well, the
expression.
Well, I was going to mention that because that's what I drink mainly is cold Guinness. But, Guinness is a tricky thing. You've got to keep it well. And, So but it shouldn't be like ice cold. You don't want it to be like ice cold sort of lager that you can really chill down. So, I don't know.
That makes sense, but then that's why you probably wouldn't find a Miller Lite in England. Well, probably there's several reasons for that, but you couldn't probably get it cold enough, right, to be able to drink.
I mean,
that was one thing that I've always kind of noticed about the UK, and every time that I went and visited when I was living in Europe, was always kind of in the autumn, in the winter, very cold, much colder than Portugal. And I was like, man, for such a cold country, their beer is so warm.
Yeah, but you're going to all the wrong places, though, Andre. You got to go to, you know, some of these more sort of, you know, with it kind of like indie kind of like craft beer sort of places where they know how to, they know their beer. These are sort of like, these are kind of like, you know, Wetherspoons. I don't know if you've heard of that, but they're kind of not very nice, cheap beer sort of places where I don't know if that's where you were drinking, but yeah, there are some decent boozers. I mean, you just got to hunt them out, you know.
Yeah, just look for the
price. I don't know, man. I took a good sample size of you know of pubs on the high street and was not impressed.
Yeah. Well, what were you drinking though?
You got to find the place that has Miller Lite on tap, and then you'll be good.
I don't think that exists over there, bro.
Well, to be fair, when I got into the beer industry, you learn, one of the first things you learn is that the United States drinks its beer too cold. Like, you're not supposed to drink beer out of a chilled glass. Yeah. It ruins the beer.
Yeah, it's blasphemous.
I totally believe that.
Absolutely. You won't have any of the aromatics. It's not going to taste the same. You're going to have stronger flavors in there to be able to pick up anything. The United States.
Look, Jess, there's no aromatics to be had. There's no aromatic.
Not in Miller Lite. No, there's not.
Not in Miller Lite. Not in Rolling Rock. And if my hand doesn't hurt from gripping the can, then we're doing something wrong.
That's right.
You're supposed to let that beer sit and warm up a little bit and then enjoy it, and you're going to get everything.
You all stop blaspheming Miller Lite. It says right on the can, fine Pilsner beer, and that's what it is. And it is also it's union made. It's a union made beer. It says it right on the can. Union made. So, but there you go.
But hey, I got to give them one thing though. The one cool thing of my experience of going into the bars in like London and Woking and the places that I was at was the tap handles and the names were so great. They're like all crazy. I still think that there was one. You know those signs that people are, I don't know if it's a sign, but I guess it's a sign. They'll put it in their front yard where it's like a woman like bending over like to tender plants or whatever, and it's kind of like her behind. They had a tap handle with that. But my favorite one, it had a picture of a bulldog on it, and the beer was called Mutt's Nuts.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
Are these the classy establishments you were referring to?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, these are the places you need to be hitting. Yeah,
there you go.
Well, it was so cool to walk around on a Sunday afternoon and be able to like go into a pub and watch part of the Formula One race at a decent time of the day and have a beer. That was cool. It was so cool. So sorry, I'll shut up now. But the Mutt's Nuts, I had to get that out there because that is just too. I can still see it in my as clear as day in my head.
Yeah, there's some great pubs all over the country. You know, it's like I suppose in the equivalents exist in other countries, don't they? But you know, the English pub is like it's an institution in itself, and it's there's so many been closing as well because of. You know, haven't reopened after COVID or even before that. We're just really struggling, and it's a shame because I know we were joking earlier about alcohol and that stuff. I mean, but I like a drink, and I kind of spent a lot of my youth, you know, hanging around pubs, whether it be playing music or chasing girls or whatever, you know. So I've got a lot of time for pubs.
But you know, it's funny though. It's such a different thing that you. Like you get a seat, but then you have to go up there and ask for the beer, right?
Yeah.
Whereas like around here, the server will come out to you. And it's not that, I don't know that one's any better than the other, but it was like really different for.
I'll tell you, sorry to interrupt, Mike. What was great during COVID when they, after one of the lockdowns, they reintroduced the pubs. A lot of pubs have been closed for months and months and they were allowed to open, but you had to move around like, I don't know whether it was the same over here in the States, but you had to kind of, if you wanted to move around the pub, you had to put a mask on. And then if you want to go to the loo or something like that, then you come back, take your mask off and carry on with your drink or whatever. But the great thing was they introduced, which is going back to your point, it's unheard of in the UK, is like table service. So it was fantastic.
Wow. So
we were like, we've tried to disengage ourselves from Europe as much as possible through Brexit, but suddenly we were kind of like almost like a European country with like people coming like to our tables and taking drinks orders. We were like, yes, this is brilliant. Finally, we're part of Europe, you know. And it was great because it was during the summer as well. So we were sitting outside in the beer gardens and the poor bar staff were just like worked off their feet, you know. But it was a taste of something nice. But now it's just back to normal. You just kind of go up to the bar again and
all you drink. I always went to the dive bars where you had to go to the bar and get no one was coming to your table. The places, yeah, the seedy joints I hung out at. And I liked it because if you sit at a booth too long and drink a lot of beer, you don't know how drunk you're getting unless you have to get up and walk to the bar once in a while and see where you're at.
That's true.
excuse me. All right. Well, all right. We got some Facebook questions to Chris. So we're going to find out what the inquiring minds of the Negative Positives Facebook group wants to know from Mr. Chris O'Connell. So, Andre, how about we go with the first question?
All righty. Christopher M. Pollan has a bit of a twofer, or actually technically only one question with one sub comment. He says here, I'd like to know which photographers influenced Chris here. I see some Rocky Shank in his images. For Mike, Rocky worked with Alice in Chains for stills and videos. Hmm. And Rocky's black and white images influenced my work a lot, as did Dwayne Michaels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know Dwayne Michaels' work better. But I suppose they're sort of in two halves, those influences, because when I first started, as I was explaining earlier, to really get into exploring, you know, shooting with film, I was, apart from Salgado, whose work, you know, I really liked, another person who was a big, somebody who was just like in my head all the time, you know, because I was just so in awe of his work, was a Australian photographer called Trent Park. I don't know if you've come across his stuff, who shot a lot of stuff in black and white, more latterly shooting in color, but some stuff he shot through the mid sort of noughties, you know, sort of 2008 upwards, was just absolutely incredible, the tones he was getting. So I'd encourage people to check him out online and we'll buy some of his stuff. You know, he's just absolutely incredible. And it was all sort of shot in mainly, I mean, he had some really shot a major project off the Australian sort of mainland. So it was all like around the bush or it was shot in places like Adelaide and Sydney, where he talked about the light in Adelaide was just, you know, he would just spend hours just trying to take the same picture again and again to get the light because it was so spectacular in that part of Australia. So, you know, so he was a big influence for me because, you know, again, it's all about light, isn't it? You can forget with you when you're standing there staring at something and you want to take a picture and you're thinking, oh, you know, what f-stop should I use or how do I approach this, you know? And actually it's all about just trying to, I think, you know, about trying to read the light in that situation. So he was he was a big influence just getting me going and like getting excited about analog photography. And then the Dwayne Michaels thing, yeah, is interesting because he again, was an influence for me. But I kind of stumbled across him in the fact that I'd started to kind of like destroy the work I was making before I discovered him. But then when I came across him, I was like, oh, wow, you know, this guy's been doing this for years, you know, and this is really kind of up my street, you know. And he also developed this idea of sequencing as well, which I thought was interesting that he would, rather than a single shot capturing a moment, he developed a series of images that kind of were all about the same moment, but they were sort of slightly altered in different ways. So you had a sequence of stuff. And that, again, was really interesting to me. Like kind of, if you look at some of the stuff on Instagram or on the website, you know, that's something I've really experimented with is taking this almost the same picture or a slightly different one, but then trying to then interpret that in both of them in different ways, but it kind of almost becomes like a way of kind of seeing the world. You know, it's not about capturing the decisive moment, but almost like a series of moments, capturing time as you sort of see it go past you kind of thing, which is another guy called English photographer called Paul Graham, who spent a lot of time, well, he lives in America now, I think, but he spent a lot of time in America. He did that a body of work called A Shimmer of Possibility, where he traveled across the States just taking sort of everyday pictures, really. But like one thing that stuck in my head was he was standing on a street corner, I think, in New York, and he just like by a crossing, you know, and like he just took a picture all the time of all, you know, series of pictures of different people walking across and going across. At one point, you know, is a guy sort of dressed, looks very much like the guy who works down Wall Street or whatever, and then like 2 seconds behind him is could be exactly the same guy. They're pretty much the same age, same ethnicity or whatever, but actually this guy is like lives on the streets, but he's still walking across the same, you know. So trying to see the world in a very specific way through a series of sequence of images, which I thought was, yeah, that really stuck with me. So Dwayne Michaels, I suppose really helped me to sort of reaffirm that what I was doing was kind of wasn't, you know, what you were saying earlier about I wasn't just breaking the rules and producing crap. There was some kind of like precedence for what I was doing. So that was really kind of helpful to me.
All right, very cool. Yeah. So did these influences, I mean, did you like see their photography and then try to emulate it? Or do you think it just happened to be a situation where you felt like, you know, you found your thing, and then you realized that it was kind of similar to your influences? I mean, how did that work? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was more that kind of way around. It's hard, you know, it's a bit like with music, isn't it? It's like, you know, when you begin to sort of write music or start, you know, you realize that the song you actually sit down to write is made up of a composite of so many different influences.
Yeah.
Some of which you've kind of followed literally, like you've gone in and you've bought an album by so-and-so, and then you kind of like, and you've read the sort of sleeve notes and it's produced by particularly, you love the production. So you buy that guy's, you buy something else by that producer as well, you know, but it actually has a slightly different flavor, obviously, because it's a different band. But, you know, so it's a bit like that really with, with that kind of work and with just how things have gone, is that you just sort of follow your nose a little bit and, but also be receptive to stuff like in the dark room, I was kind of written something with paint on a piece of paper. I can't think what it was now, but and then Julia, my wife, you know, she came in and she sort of said, my handwriting is absolutely, I think, is terrible, but she said, your handwriting is like really interesting because it's very textural, you know, in the fact that, you know, it goes all over the place, and yet that's really interesting in the fact that there's hardly any structure to it. She said it's very distinctive, and I kind of thought, so that just kind of stuck with me. And so then when I was working on some later sort of stuff, you know, experimental, I just started to write across the print and incorporate some text into it as well, you know, like scratched it in or just like wrote with some paint across it. And of course, all these are the kind of things as well that people like Dwayne Michaels was doing. So, you know, whether that be, you know, it's kind of like a subliminal, I don't know whether that was before I discovered him or after or whatever, but these are all the kind of things of like he was saying, doing with his work, is that you can just take that image and just do what you need to do to it to kind of like say your bit, you know, to sort of finish the story or add to the story or, you know, whatever you kind of feel you need to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Especially with music or, yeah, I guess even in photography, anytime you have influences, you may not actually set out to, you know, like copy or emulate those things, but they are back there, like kind of subconsciously in your mind. And it brings me, I think I've probably told the story before, but it brings me to one night at band practice, me and the bass player got together and we were just trying to write some new ideas to bring to the band for the next week or whatever. And we spent hours writing this, I had this riff, you know, we kept going over and over with it and we started working on it, you know. And my bass player had to go to the restroom, which was down the hall from our practice room. And he goes to the restroom and I'm still working on the riff, you know, I'm jamming the riff out, you know, I think I got something here. And he comes back in, he's like, Mike, we got to scrap this. I'm like, well, what do you mean, man? He's like, we just wrote Cranberry Zombie. And so basically I was basically just ripping off the Cranberry Zombie guitar riff. So,
yeah. Oh man. And when that's subconscious, isn't that the worst? Like you didn't intend that to happen at all, but like somehow it does.
Yeah, and but such a basic thing like that. How did I not recognize that was zombie? Why did it take us 2 hours? Why did somebody have to step away from it before we realized we were riding zombie? Like, I don't understand. Like,
hey man, you were in the forest. You couldn't see the trees.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Chris, have you ever had a situation where maybe you're trying to emulate something that you've seen or whatever, and then realize that maybe you did it too perfectly? Like, this
yeah. You mean in terms of the photography or just generally with music?
Music, any creative outlet. You ever run into that?
I think, I mean, I remember trying to sort of write a song exactly the same. You know, the Sultans of Swing by Dire Straits. Mm-hmm. And I remember just spending hours sort of trying to write my own kind of version of that. And it was just like, I couldn't get anywhere with it because it didn't sound enough like the song that I was trying to emulate, you know, and it was just completely pathetic way to go about trying to create something interesting. It's just like trying to copy something. But again, that's what, I suppose that's what influences are though, isn't it? Is that you pick them. I remember reading something a while back where Paul McCartney, you know, when the myth goes that he woke up with the song Yesterday in his head, and he just wrote it down really quickly and called it Scrambled Eggs, to the lyric, you know, but he was convinced that he'd, when he woke up, you know, he'd woken up with it in his head, but he thought it was another song that someone else had already written. And so he played it to one of the band and said, look, what is this? Who wrote this? And like, they're going, I don't know it. And it took him a few days to be convinced that he'd actually just woken up with it. That's his story anyway. But but it wasn't, it wasn't obviously an original riff. No one had written it, but he just thought, I've heard it before, you know. So I guess, isn't it, they say there's only 6 original stories in the world or something like that, and what's the is it the circle of fifths or circle of eighths or something in music, you know, where it all just, there's only a certain amount of notes that you can use or something.
Yeah, it's probably everything's been written by this point. You're probably copying somebody, you know, no matter how you look at it. So
And that's photography, right? I mean, really, probably everything in photography has been done.
Yeah.
Except that you haven't done it, that I haven't done my version of it, right? Even if I try to copy that, but like, so there's still room for us to make new stuff, but it's not a totally new.
Well, you see it when you go on photo walks, like, you know, you have if you're shooting with somebody else, like I mentioned going out with my sons a couple, you know, a month or so ago, and we were taking photos, and, you know, his photos were, even though we were taking pictures of the exact same things, exact same locations, completely different photos, you know, so like, it's definitely everyone has their unique take on it. So, yeah, I guess you can't be too wrapped up in worrying about what you're copying these days. Everything's been done, right? So,
yeah,
you just got to put your spin on it. Yeah, but. And God knows, Chris definitely puts his spin on his photography. So, all right. Well, let's move on to the. Do we feel like we got that one, or move on to the next Facebook question? I guess it'd be Jess. Yeah, Jess, can you read that one?
Yeah. Larry Effler says your work is great, but your experimental dreaming still life photos are especially inspiring for me. Could you share a little about your process for making these?
That's very kind of him to say that. Thank you.
Since this is an audio podcast, could I maybe explain what that is until some people will know until they can get a chance to check it out?
Yeah. So there's a series of, they're kind of still life, I suppose, moments just captured around the sort of banal environment of the house, of, you know, where I live. And I was, they were, I think all of them were, there's probably 6 or 7 of them. My glasses sort of on the kitchen table, but the light sort of pouring across the table and through the glasses. And so, you know, just that nice kind of, what's the word, diffusion of light through the glasses and through the lens, you know. There's another picture. I don't know why I did it, but there was, some stones out on the decking, and I sort of picked them up and I put them inside a plastic freezer bag, you know, that you put your sandwiches in or whatever, and filled it with water and hung it with a clothes peg on the line. And it was just like these two rocks just kind of hanging in this plastic bag. And actually funnily enough, talking about my brother-in-law, who I'm staying with at the moment, this was a few years ago, and they were over visiting, and we were standing in the kitchen. He said, "Chris, what is it with the rocks in the bag?" So I'm just taking pictures of them. He's like, "Oh, right, okay." You know, so he just did. But I don't know why I did it. And they hung there for ages. They were there. I think they went on for about another year. I didn't move them. And so it was those kind of pictures. There was another one of some plants, again, just like that I kind of mainly sort of photographed or shot against the incoming sun, because our house is sort of south facing, so we kind of get loads of sun pouring in through the kitchen, especially at sort of golden hour sort of time, you know. But the thing with all of them, they were all kind of shot on like 6x7, and what I was, I suppose I was just, you know, saying before, I'd been not very technical, whereas I was really interested in trying to sort of explore that sort of thing of shooting for the shadows or for the highlights. So I was kind of like moving across those zones, like, you know, two stops down or one stop up or whatever, from whatever the meter had said. So that was kind of part of what I was experimenting with. But also, again, just that more, I suppose, sort of mind, you know, sort of story sort of thing in my head is like, you know, the French guy who talked about the decisive moment, the really famous French photographer.
Henri Cartier-Bresson.
Thank you. Yeah. So he talked about, you know, that photography is arguably by, you know, some people argue is kind of defined by that decisive moment, you know, you catch it. But I was quite interested in was these were pictures which had been taken just after that, you know, so that the glasses were left on the table, but by whom, sort of thing, you know, and that the rocks were there. But why were the rocks there? As my brother-in-law quite rightly said, like, what's all that about? You know, so I was just experimenting, I suppose, just like that. That's why it's that idea of the title is Experimental Dreaming. It was just, just playing around with images, but trying to sort of make them, I suppose, yeah, have an ambiguity to them as well, really.
That one of the rocks in the bag was definitely my favorite, because it reminded me, and I don't know if you guys have this in the UK, but it reminded me of, like, you know, the carnival games or like the prize that you get at the state fair with the little goldfish in the plastic bag. So yeah. I'm trying to zoom into that. I'm like, wait, is that a fish? Is that a potato?
No, it's a rock.
It just it just reminds me of these like childhood memories of like carnivals and the state fair.
But you know when I quite like the idea of leaving stuff on the washing line as well, and like going back to it, you know. So that bag gradually got more, the water became more and more mouldy because it was there through different climates, different seasons as well. So obviously rainwater kind of got in through the gaps. So it just, the whole thing became this congealed, sort of quite soggy kind of mess inside as well. So I photographed some of that on colour and things because it was just interesting just to kind of see how it sort of developed. And like, you know, again, when I don't know what it was like for you guys over here, but when COVID broke in the UK, you know, like some people were, you know, apart from masks, people were wearing like the kind of the, you know, the doctor's gloves type thing, you know. And we wore those a couple of times until we gradually, you know, you educate yourself, don't you? And you really, you know, think it's probably more about aerosols rather than touch and all that stuff. So we stopped wearing them. But in those early days, you know, we were kind of wearing them, and then we kind of washed some of them out and hung them on the line. Because it was impossible to get hold of them because there was just nothing around to buy. Because we were all so prepared for a pandemic. but they stayed on there again for about a year, and in the end they were just like a big kind of crinkly mess. And I took them off, they kind of collapsed in my hands, you know, because they'd just kind of been fried by the sun and sort of destroyed by the frost and warmed back up again and whatever. But, you know, I took a load of photos of those. It was, yeah. So that's kind of where that sort of, and again, I suppose back to the sequences again. So like lots of repetitive sequence of images, almost like exploring a similar sort of idea, really, of arriving afterwards.
I like this photo of the bag of rocks was sort of like you subliminally saying, "Hey, my photography rocks," right? What?
Yeah. I mean, let's go.
Man, like, you know, I thought I had a good one there, but that just fell it fell like
a tough crowd.
I just, yeah, a bit of tumbleweed just kind of blew past me.
I might have to insert the cricket noise on that one. I don't know, but all right. Anybody else have any follow-ups with the subject besides mine that fell on flat notes or whatever?
Well, I was curious.
Go ahead.
I was curious if there are other methods that you're interested in trying out, because it looks like you've got a good feel for what you're currently doing. I was wondering if you are satisfied in the work that you're making, or if there's other experimental works you want to start trying out.
Yeah, I've sort of got to a little bit of a point where I can remember, you know, when I've listened to this podcast and you go around and sort of talk about what you've been doing for the week and stuff, and it was a couple of times when I think it was you, Mike, was saying, you know, I've still got a roll of film in the camera, and I just have, you know, it's been there ages, and I'm kind of at that point at the moment. And I remember when you said that, I was like, how is that possible? You know, I could just go out tomorrow and shoot a whole roll of film, and no problem, you know. But it's that kind of creative thing is kind of, for me, is just a little bit on hold at the moment, you know, with, I think, because I worked in such a kind of with such industry through making that work over the last 2 or 3 years, that I've kind of got to a point where I'm not quite sure what I want to do next, really, you know. So I haven't been in the dark room for weeks, months, really, because of what the weather's been so good, so I've mainly been out cycling and whatever, you know. So I kind of, yeah, I'm, to answer your question, Jess, I'm kind of at that point where I'm waiting for that next thing. I'm a really big believer in sort of transitions, you know, sort of creatively, and that things just kind of come alive for you, but you can't force them, you know. So I think it's just like as the weather changes, I'll probably go back and start printing stuff again, but may even revisit the same idea, but try to different results, or I don't know. I mean, I just need to kind of think about, yeah, just what can I do to sort of distract the image as much as possible, but at the same time that it feels still truthful and that it's not just gratuitous, you know. It's for me, it's just a bit of a waiting game, really, and just kind of waiting for that. And let's say passion, because I still have a passion for it, but just waiting for the kind of the muse to sort of strike a bit at the moment. Does that answer your question? You know, I don't quite know.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's good to take a reset sometimes, you know, and let inspiration come back. And maybe don't take as long as a reset as I have, but, you know, just.
Yeah, but if you're not feeling it, Mike, you're not feeling it.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's not feeling it. It's just, you know, I've had other interests that I've been pursuing lately, and you know, it's it'll come when it comes. And you know, I have kind of slowly gotten back into it, and it's been on my own terms and when I felt inspired to do it. And I don't feel like there's any reason to force inspiration, because that usually doesn't end up with good results, you know. So I think you just you know, I think sometimes you have to wait till you're inspired and then jump on it then, you know.
You sort of feel guilty for it as well, you know, within yourself, obviously. Because you kind of think, well, this is what I do, you know, why am I not taking photographs? But, everybody at some point has or will continue to face those creative struggles, you know. So you just have to kind of, in some respects, you just have to wait it out and just keep looking, keep listening, keep being aware of, you know, as much as you can of what's going on with other different, you know, around you, not even just through photography, just anything. What's a stimulus that might hit you?
Sure, I agree.
And then try and sort of work with that, you know. Mm-hmm. Good.
All right, well, I think we went down some rabbit holes on that one. So that was a good conversation. I appreciate your all's insights on that. And I think we can take us a break and come back for a final segment and follow up with Chris with anything else we want to. This is where we get out our deep probes. So
I could be in on the deep probing. I've been wanting to do this for a long time, man.
Yeah, well, that's what we do around here. So, all right, let's take us one final break, and we'll come back and follow up with some last couple of things we want to talk about with Chris. So we'll be right back, folks. right, folks, we're back for the final segment, and this is where we pull out our deep probes and probe Mr. Chris O'Connell a little further, a little deeper, a little more intimate, I think. And, but I don't know how many people on the show, but anyway, I'm going to start off.
They want to get probed.
I'm going to start off. Well, I got a couple questions for him, so I'm going to start off with one of mine first. Chris, you sent me, I guess it might have been about a year ago or so, one of the best zines that I've received. I mean, I've received some really awesome zines, and I'm not trying to play favorites, but this one really stuck out to me. It was Turnip for Life was the name of the zine, and it's beautiful. And one of the things that struck me about it was in those photos, you use the process of apparently using some India ink on, I guess, the prints, the darkroom prints, I'm guessing is how you did it.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Could you tell a little bit about that zine, if it's still available, and how you did this India ink thing? Because just the blacks were just amazing. I've always been a fan of, like, you know, really high contrast, deep blacks in photography. And this the zine had it in spades. And I kind of wonder, was the photos already contrasty, or was it the India ink that added that extra element of the darkness to it? It really blew me away. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, thanks for saying that, Mike. I think not all, but a lot of the photos were pretty contrasty. I printed them sort of really trying to work on the blacks, but equally it was a process of experimentation a bit as well, in the fact that I printed them at different grades, if you like, so that because I knew I was going to treat them with the ink. So sometimes something that was very contrasty actually was too much to then put the ink over, because then it just became almost, the image became submerged in, you know, in this kind of blackness almost, you know. So sometimes I would actually, the ink would create a lot of the darks that you talked about, but at the same time sometimes I just went with stuff that I'd had printed on maybe like a sort of grade 4 or something like that, you know, so it was pretty dark anyway. The blacks were pretty dark, and then just kind of, so then adjusted, you know, the amount of Indian ink that I kind of used on the top of that. So it was kind of like a bit of a mixture of the two, really, just kind of seeing you know, what worked best for them. And that was really it. I mean, and some of them were some of the images were, again, weren't, you know, technically weren't the best, you know. Some of them were, I'd shot, you know, into the sun, or I'd kind of like, the composition wasn't great, but then I kind of went around, so I, you know, I sort of did stuff where I just kind of printed it, you know. So just, if you take like the question of the composition, you know, and I sort of think that just doesn't look that great, but then I, you know, I could either sort of go back to it and just kind of crop right into it, which I sometimes did, because then that kind of gave like a really quite nice sort of grainy, sort of distorted sort of result. So that was even more pleasing, you know. Or I just kind of like cut the print up with scissors afterwards and just kind of like used the bit I wanted, and then just scanned that, you know, and used and created an image, digital image that way, sort of thing. So that was mainly the kind of the process behind it. And that was kind of, again, I suppose, thinking that sort of what I said before about looking and sort of seeing, you know. So that was about really just kind of, you know, having lived in Coventry for a large part of my life, not all of it, but, you know, for quite a considerable amount of my life, you know, that you actually can spend a long time there and not really be seeing anything, you know. You just kind of like, you just walk the same steps the same day, go to the same sort of places, you know, and actually kind of miss lots of stuff in the gaps in between. So that was, I suppose, what that book was about in a way, was like, you know, to turn up for life, because you can just kind of ghost walk through it, sleep walk through it, you know. Which is kind of, I think, where we are, you know, just to get heavy for a minute, but you said it was a deep probe, you know. It's kind of you know, I think, so, you know, that's kind of where we've ended up socially and politically, you know, is that we're just kind of sleepwalking. And yeah, so that's kind of, I suppose, because there's word, I should say that there's actually text in through that as well. I was sort of, that's where I was really experimenting with bringing my writing, which we talked right back at the beginning of the episode about, you know, bringing the writing and the imagery together, and actually storytelling in that way. So it's just a very short story of a guy, you know, sort of walking through through the city centre, you know, and like saying, you know, did the world change and did I change when the world changed? And, you know, it's that just that introspection of like, am I really kind of present here or not? Mm-hmm. So that was kind of where that kind of came from.
So how did you, and as far as the process goes, because in case people, is the zine still available? Do you still have copies of it?
Yeah, it's, it's printed on the, through Blurb, you know, I sort of self-published sort of thing. So yeah, it's, you can buy it on the website, just in the shop section, you know, I can, I think I've got two or three copies still, and then otherwise, if there was a sudden rush on them, then I could, it'd just be a question of like getting another bunch printed, basically.
Okay. And as far as the process though, so you basically made the darkroom print, and then you did the ink on the print. Did you use like brushes, or I mean, what's the process there?
I just used a cloth, you know, just like a sort of like cotton cloth, and just kind of like literally just tip the ink out onto the cloth, and then just kind of like lightly sort of smeared it across, you know, and then go backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, and just adding to it, you know, where I kind of wanted a bit more effect. I think in some cases I may have used sandpaper on some of it afterwards as well. I'm not sure. Can't quite recall now. But yeah, that was mainly just the process. Just that was the first time when I really start to sort of have that feeling of like, it doesn't feel enough. I need to kind of make more of it. And that's when I just kind of just attacked it with the Indian ink.
Well, it really was amazing. It kind of did blow me away. There's a grittiness to it that I really liked. It actually kind of reminded me of one of my favorite photographers, Anton Corbin, of his gritty black and white work kind of reminded me a little bit of that. But I mean, he wasn't using India ink or anything like that. But there was a grittiness to some of the photos that kind of reminded me of his work, which I always kind of respond to. But it's really, and actually what I like about it too, like, I mean, I could have, I mean, yes, obviously, there's photos in there that, you know, you can tell have been manipulated in some sort of way or whatever. But a lot of it, like, even though you told me in the letter you included or whatever that, you know, there was India ink involved or whatever in it. And some of it, you really couldn't tell that it wasn't a straight photograph, but you knew that something was different about it, you know? So it was like some of it was subtle, you know, but some of it wasn't, you know, his obviously, it was very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Also, I think the other part of the effect, of course, was that when I then scanned that, so I've got the gelatin print, and then I've used the Indian ink on it. But then once that's dry, obviously, I've then scanned it. And so, you know, the scan again gives a completely different texture. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was really exciting to me when I realized that, because I just worked on all the prints to begin with. And then I sort of thought, right, I need to commit them to, I need to create like a digital image so I can get the stuff printed. Excuse me. And then when I started scanning it, I was like, wow, that's sort of done something else to it as well, which I just didn't figure in the process at all.
Oh, nice.
So actually, you know, even though I always prefer to print, you do get some really interesting images then from scanning prints, you know.
Sure, yeah.
So, and especially if you're kind of like experimenting with stuff as I do, then it kind of, the effects it creates is really quite rich as well.
And the photos in that zine are actually on your website as well, right?
Yes, they are. But the text isn't, but the photos are, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I definitely, people should check that out and get a copy of that zine. I'm telling you, you will be blown away by it. It's amazing. So thank you so much for sending that to me, Chris. It really was inspiring, truthfully. And
thanks for the words as well, Mike. Appreciate that.
Oh, no, my pleasure, man. Thanks for sending it to me. All right, let's go to Andre. What do you got, Andre?
So I think the series of images that kind of provoked the most intense emotions in me when I was looking at them on your website was a series called Ghost Path, B-side. So yeah. I mean, the softball is like, well, what was the A side if these were the B sides? But also, you know, I want to understand a little bit more about kind of how these were made, because depending on the image, there's some that almost look kind of angry to me, in that I remember, or the thing that it reminds me of is, you know, and you've probably seen it in movies and TV shows, but the classic example of like the bullied kid who like scratches out the pictures of like the bullies in the yearbook, the sort of scratched out outlines, I don't know if that was with the sandpaper, of some of these figures. It's just such an interesting, really visceral look that I don't think I'd seen other than those examples that I mentioned. So can you just talk a little bit more kind of about that, how that that technique came to be and sort of what you were feeling? Because, I mean, again, that's just my initial interpretation that they look angry, but that's not necessarily, you know, what you intended by them.
Yeah, no, I don't suppose I was angry, but I was kind of trying to capture, I suppose, you know, an emotion which was probably not directly related, but, you know, subliminally or subconsciously, there was stuff I was trying to express through that, you know, perhaps. I mean, the Ghost Path was sort of, project was kind of connected, you know, a bit to the Turn Up for Life thing again, of like, of just this, I'm quite interested in sort of repetition, but also sort of, you know, that idea that of degradation as well. So that, you know, I suppose the human experience in many respects is one of repetition, but also that each of those repetitions is degrading in the fact that, I don't mean maybe that's not the right word, is but yeah, it degrades rather than you emotionally, it like degrades the kind of the quality of your existence, you know, the more and more you go on and do the same things again and again and again. So I was trying to sort of,
especially if they're stupid things.
Yeah. Yeah. But also just the, every, you know, I mean, you think about, you know, I mean, I suppose I was conscious of my kind of privilege as well. And the fact that, you know, I'm kind of privileged to be able to do the things that I do. Whereas, you know, there are people who kind of just have to sort of do what they can do to get by, and like that means the same walk every day past the same sort of building to the same place where they're kind of doing whatever, you know, and they don't have a lot of choice because the money's got to come in, or, you know. So I was trying to think about that I suppose, so I sort of spent, there was all of those photos, there was a lot more of them, but I just chose those ones, were all taken sort of on just one particular pathway which went through the city centre, and there was like some hoardings, white hoardings sort of on the street, which had been there for years, and behind it was some wasteland that hadn't been built on, and I just kind of stood on the corner there, and just kind of shot like a roll of film of just different people going by, you know. But then in the dark room I printed them as positive, but I also printed them as negatives as well. So actually what you've got on that is that, so the A side is the positive image, and the B side, what you see on the website, is the negative image. So I was kind of like obviously doing like a contact print to kind of create the negative that you see on there. So actually, you know, you're not really, so in a way you're kind of seeing the inside of it, if you like, of the photo. That's how I thought of it. It's a bit like being sort of in sort of behind the kind of the positive, you know. I'm kind of not making a lot of sense here, but that was some of the thinking behind it. So they weren't even whole, if you like. They were somehow detached from the kind of like the proper representation of what they should look like, which is like, you know, should have been a positive image. So that, yeah, and then it was using again sandpaper and some bits of ink as well to kind of paint over some of the buildings in the background. And then also I kind of cut up some of them and then joined them together, but they weren't quite joined up properly, or they weren't necessarily matching. So like, I think there's a picture of a girl walking down the street with a baseball cap on, but I kind of did about three different versions of that and then put them all together on one big sort of, I put them all together on a piece of card and then sort of scanned that. So actually it's three different versions of the same thing. So, but none of them really match up, like feet are in different positions or whatever, you know, because they weren't all cut to precision. So it was just experimenting really with that, again, just trying to just kind of capture that grittiness, you know, that you mentioned, Mike, you know, that cities are kind of gritty, grubby, sort of quite painful places as well, you know, as well as being fantastic places as well, you know. So that was, yeah, that was a lot of stuff going on with it.
Very cool. Very cool.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
Man, talk about, yeah. I mean, what I like about when I'm learning about you, Chris, and I mean, I guess I kind of knew from the zine, but like you think a lot about the stuff, man. Like I just kind of go out and shoot willy nilly, man. Like it, like you actually seem to have a a theme or something going on that where you think about like how to interpret these photos, and maybe that's something that I don't spend enough time with,
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I don't know. I mean, I suppose it is partly to do with being a story, you know, a storyteller anyway, mm-hmm. by trade. You know, that's what I've been paid to do. I guess there's just always just that idea of narrative is just behind everything. And I think, you know, and like, as I talked about earlier, you know, absorbing and really beginning to embrace this idea of sequence, of repetition, that kind of unlocked a lot, you know, so just taking the same sort of self-portrait again and again, but treating it differently somehow says, you know, for me, expresses what I want to express about my life or who I am or whatever, you know, just through that repetition, because you can then do the work on top of it to explore it. So, yeah, so I suppose there's always some kind of thematic, sort of issue that I suppose I go out with, as opposed to thinking about single images, which I did, you know, shoot a lot of when I first really began to kind of get to grips with stuff. But then morphed into this slightly different, weirder approach.
it's working, man. It's definitely working. All right, Mike, Kukavica, Kooks, you got anything for Chris?
Absolutely, I do. So you mentioned in passing, and you kind of referenced it a moment ago, Chris, that you're a playwright by trade, right?
Yeah.
Because I can see there's a connection to photography. That's what I want to get to. And I'm kind of stumbling over myself to try to get there. But so like, what could you tell me, because I guess I'm a little uneducated, what actually the role of a playwright is?
Well, it's to, so, I mean, it's a kid, you know, it's the brother or sister of a screenplay that you watch. So, like, you know, if you think of the last film that you watched, you know, it's essentially a narrative with a bunch of characters, okay. and a plot line and stuff. And it's a similar thing that I've written, but you approach it from a theatre point of view. So it happens, you know, in real time, obviously, and it's kind of a construct of a story with, you know, a series of unfolding events. But, you know, but also exploring that through metaphor as well, I suppose. So, like, I mean, I know we were talking about time, so I'll be really quick. But I many years ago, I worked with a lot of young offenders in prisons and things like that, through theatre, you know, through kind of making work and making plays or poetry or whatever. It wasn't just me; it was with other people as well. But I met, and at one point, I was working with the probation service. I don't know what the equivalent is in the States, but these were young. These were kids. I was meeting lots of kids who were stealing cars, who had been remanded in custody, so they were brought over to the courts the following morning, you know, and they were just obsessed with stealing cars, you know, joyriding and stuff like that. And I did that work for a couple of years, but I became really interested in it in terms of going back to what we're saying a little bit about the, you know, whether it's gratuitous or not, and it being appropriate to take photographs. It was a similar thing. I was like, what's my relationship to all these? I'm a writer, but at the moment I'm trying to make a living, so I'm working in the probation service, and I'm meeting these kids who've got these incredible stories to tell. What do I do with that information, you know? And what came out of that was a series of plays I wrote, which were exploring young people in crisis, if you like. And I wrote this play called Car, and it was basically about a guy a bit like me, you know, middle class guy whose car sort of stolen, and actually how that changes him. So I was trying to write in relationship to crime, my relationship to crime and punishment. But to going back to the idea of metaphor, that play was completely written out of sequence. So it was like going backwards and forwards, and like the first six scenes were like really, really fast and quick, a bit like stealing a car would be. So I was trying to sort of like because I know I couldn't make a film of it. It should be easy to do that on a film. So how do you do it in theatre? So I'm kind of rambling a bit, but I'm saying I've always been attracted to that sort of metaphor of, you know, so I suppose the photographs of like Ghost Path or whatever is how could I kind of try and show the repetition of someone's life? It's through a series of different images and then working on them to get them to a state which somehow reflects what I feel about that. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, it definitely does.
And so like to try to confirm that I'm thinking the right thing. So you're in one way writing, being a playwright, writing plays is not terribly different from photography from the conceptual point of view. Not to use a business term, but the deliverable is different.
Yeah.
But the idea, because that's where I was going. What I wanted to ask was like, how does being a playwright inform your photography? But you just answered that in spades. It's the same thing, right?
The other way around as well, though, that I began to realize that just by going out and taking photographs, I was actually beginning to think more stories were beginning to occur to me that I could write as well. So it was actually the two sort of feed each other.
So, oh, that's awesome. That's because that's what photography, I mean, like at the root, and my personal opinion, photography is about trying to get you to think. The viewer, the person that you're trying to reach, whoever that, it's anyone looking at your stuff, right, is who you're trying to reach. But the emotion and the thought, and to like provoke thought or emotion, either which way. And it sounds like you already figured out how to do that.
Yeah, well, still kind of still figuring it out as I go along. Because, like, I mean, going back to Jesse's question earlier, that's kind of that process at the moment is on pause for me as well, because I've sort of, you know, it's like that creative. It's, I suppose, it's not like a block, but you know, just at the moment, I've found that great sort of symbiosis between those two disciplines. But at the same time, I'm now at the point where I don't quite understand or quite know at the moment where I go with that, any of that at the moment, you know.
Well, it's probably also mentally exhausting, right? I mean, like there's like some books or some experiences that like you really have to be present and like invested in, and it takes a lot of effort, and you can't always do that 100% because it's you know, like, yeah. If that makes sense. I mean, I don't know, maybe that's trying to read something in that's not there. No. But I feel like with you, that's the thing, right? So, you know, yeah, it's probably not something you can just go, oh, I'm going to do this today. It's like,
yeah, no,
you have to be feeling it, right? And ready to put forth the effort.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And like, you can't sort of fudge it. You've just got to be in the right frame of mind, you know, and if it's not happening, it's not happening. You just have to kind of do something else, you know, go for a bike ride or put some music on or
drink.
Drink. Yeah, you said that.
Or drink. That's
crack open an ice.
Go out and buy some Miller Lite and just
get some Miller Lite and giddy, you're ready. You're ready to, you're tasting freedom and you're, you know, you got the freedom.
Come on, you could have some Mutz Nuts. I mean, come on. You know, I mean, how bad could that be?
All right. So
you've already find warm pale beer.
All right, Jess, do you have something for Chris?
No, I feel like you hit all the marks for me.
Awesome. Well, I have one last thing. I have to talk about this as a someone that pretends to be a musician. Chris, you have been a musician, and you've you know, done some, and you actually sent me some music to play on listener interaction episodes. You sent me like three tracks that I have in the queue. I always have to ask this because I'm interested in this this sort of facet. Like, do you see any connection between your music and photography, how they inform each other, or any sort of way that like music influences your photography or any way? Because I know you've talked a lot about how being a playwright has done that, but what about on the music side of things? Because I know that you had a band that I would consider what we would call post-rock, which is what my last successful, semi-successful band was. And and post-rock is a very, it's definitely a music that only certain, it's kind of it's a niche sort of market, obviously, but it's definitely sort of a, it's a type of music that kind of builds scenes in people's minds in a little bit, because the way it just the structure of it, it's sort of it's often been used in actually soundtrack music for movies, that type of music is because it has a sort of thematic cinematic sort of sound the way it builds up generally. So I'm just kind of interested in that little aspect. I had to get that in there to just just see what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, no, that's actually no, I've not really brought photography or any of my work to the band in that respect. We've used a couple of, there was some music we released, I think just before COVID broke, where we kind of we used some images on that I'd created on the album on the artwork. But apart from that, no, we've not really sort of begun from any kind of photographic sort of influence or anything like that. But I always, you know, I've always kind of like, again, gone on to them about narrative, and they're like, what are you on about? You know, just like play the tune, you know, sort of. But I'd be kind of like, yeah, but, you know, what's the story? Because with post-rock, for those who don't sort of follow it or aren't so well informed, you know, certainly the way we work, you know, we call it like post-rock jazz, because it's like we just make it up literally as we went along. Uh-huh. And we get to a point where we'd stop and go, like, what happens now? And that's where I'd kind of go, well, what's the story we're trying to tell? And they're like, I don't know. So, well, okay, well, let's think about, what does it feel like? What does this, what we've written so far, how does it make us feel, you know, and et cetera, et cetera, you know. And so, and then you gradually realize that actually we just talk around just stuff, and you realize that potentially, you know, we're all kind of reacting in different ways to the social climate or whatever. So, and so we'd kind of like just think, okay, so, well, the next bit then is maybe it's this or maybe it's that, you know, in terms of what we'd, so, but we kind of discovered it as we went along, really. Mm-hmm. And just kind of wrote it, and then we could never remember it when we came back to it. So
yeah, we had that issue too. That's the problem with post-rock songs. They tend to be long, and there's a lot of parts. And I remember when we would play live, I would have to, like, I would try to count in my head the sections, and I would have to nod to the drummer to go to the next section so we wouldn't screw up, because it was, you know, there's a lot of parts and a lot of measures going on. So
it was, we just completely relied on our drummer, because he sort of counted everything, you know, whereas me and the other two guitarists, we were just like, we were just playing our stuff and waiting for him to kind of give us the nod, you know.
Right.
So it wasn't it sounded all right, but we released an album, I think 2014 or whatever, and it only had four tracks on it, and they were all, well, the last track was 23 minutes long, I think. We were really proud of.
Yeah, I think our longest was 13 minutes. So, but
we beat you.
Very nice. Well, you will be hearing some of Chris's music on a future listener interaction shows. He sent me a couple, three tracks.
Yeah.
So I'll definitely be playing some of that in future listener interaction episodes at the end. So you'll get to hear some of that. But if people wanted to check out any of the band or music projects you've done, is there places to check that out or anything?
Yeah. The post-rock band, is called Those Amongst Us Are Wolves.
That's a great post-rock name. That's I know what I'm getting into as soon as I see that name. So
yeah, so that's on it's on all the socials, but it'll be on I think it's Those Amongst Us Are Wolves .com, I think it is, or it might be .co.uk, I'm not entirely sure, but it's also on Bandcamp as well. All the stuff's on Bandcamp. So equally, you could just go on there and just search Those Amongst Us Are Wolves, and all of the work's on there. So, that'd be probably the best way, actually.
There you go. Well, definitely, folks, check that out. So, well, Chris, thank you so much for spending your night with us. Because you could be out right now just in revelry with the Florida wild life out there.
I could be
at Walmart.
Hanging around Walmart, take some pictures down the Everglades or something, or, you know.
Right. So, but you chose to spend your evening with us, and we appreciate it. It was a really good time, and just enjoyed, finding out a whole lot about your process, and just thanks for coming on, man. It was
thanks for having me, all of you guys, and it's been great fun. Thank you.
Well, awesome. Well, how about we go ahead and get our socials out here? We'll start with you, Chris. Where can people check out all this fine work we've been talking about?
Yeah, so chrisoconnell.co.uk is the website, and then Instagram is chris_ocon_photos.
And I'll have that in the show notes so people can check that out. So, all right, Andre, where can people check you out, man?
People can check out my work on Instagram at AndreOnFilm.
And Jess Jones.
They can find me at Instagram at Yes Jones.
Yes, he won.
Isn't that Yes, he won?
It's Yes Jones. There's someone in a work email labeled me as Jesse Jones, because I think they saw my Instagram account and didn't know. And at work, I go by JJ. I don't even go by Jessica or anything. But I think they saw my Instagram and put Jesse Jones from my Yesy One.
And see, Mike had you beat down for a while, because there was a couple times you actually referred to yourself as Yesy One. So it was like, he got you over the hump.
Yep.
All right, Mike, where can people check you out, man?
Just on Instagram, I'm the drunk darkroom. So that's me.
You said that with such embarrassment.
I don't know, man. There's some days I feel strong about it, and some days I'm like, I'm regretting my choices. I don't know. But you know what? It's already done.
He's never gonna forget it.
So you just gotta press on. So,
all right, check. You can check me out on Instagram at GuttermanPhoto. You can email this program, negpositives@gmail.com. You can join the Facebook group, Negative Positives Film Photo Podcast Facebook group. And we have an Instagram account, Negative Positives, if you submit photos to Instagram. Think about using the hashtag Negative Positives, and maybe I'll get off my ass and highlight it at some point. I've been bad about that the last couple weeks. I'll fully admit that. And so I need to get back on that horse of highlighting people that use the Negative Positives hashtag. So we have you can support this program on Ko-fi. It is ko-fi.com/negativepositives. And you can get my music on Bandcamp. That is mikegutterman.bandcamp.com. And that's pretty much it. So we will talk to you all in 2 weeks for a listener interaction episode. And hey, maybe you'll hear one of Chris O'Connell's songs at the end of that one. So, but until then, thanks. Huge thanks to Chris for joining us tonight. And we will talk to you in 2 weeks. Until then, everybody stay positive.
And shoot some awesome film.
There it
is. Only you can pull that off, mister.
And sandpaper your prints and put India ink on it. All right, folks, we'll talk to you soon. Gutter Man Cave Production!